from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, we'll update you on the ongoing crisis and violence in Egypt, including the arrest of the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, and persistent questions about whether American aid ought to go to the present military regime, as well as the apparent imminent release of Hosni Mubarak following the former head of state's acquittal just yesterday. Then at 9:30, we'll hear a debate on whether the state's Coastal Commission, which was established by voter initiative back in 1972, should have the power to levy fines. A controversial bill to that effect has passed the state assembly and will likely come up for a Senate vote this week. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Former Egyptian leader Hosni Mubarak could be released from prison this week after he was acquitted yesterday of corruption charges by a Cairo court. His release could cause even more political tension and turmoil in a nation reeling from bloody protests after the army ousted President Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first freely elected president. Close to 1,000 people have been killed in the crackdown and clashes between Morsi supporters and security forces. And earlier today, the Muslim Brotherhood spiritual leader Mohamed Badi was arrested by Egyptian authorities. We want to discuss the latest news out of Egypt in this opening Forum half hour. And with us, David Kirkpatrick. He's joining us from Cairo. He's Cairo Bureau Chief for The New York Times. And David Kirkpatrick, welcome back to Forum. Good to have you.
Good to be here.
I think I'd like to begin by drawing attention to the lead piece you have in today's New York Times. And I want to, of course, hear from you what it looks like on the ground. But in reading your piece, and in recent events, particularly with the arrest of the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, with al-Bardai now being accused of betraying national trust and a trial date set for him, with Mubarak being released, it's almost a little bit too much to process. It seems like the old order is intact, or maybe in some ways even worse than the old order.
Yeah, that's about how it feels, certainly from the perspective of backers of the former president, Mohamed Morsi, and other Egyptian Islamists. I mean, they truly have never had it so bad in 80 years of repression in which they were an illegal organization. They are, although the government hasn't taken the official step of declaring the Muslim Brotherhood illegal, as a matter of fact, it is dangerous to say or be perceived as a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. They're being killed and arrested by droves. And we, to be honest, don't even have a count of how many civilians have been killed in the last week, because it's clear that the government is lying about the numbers and pressuring families to sign on to a natural cause of death when they try to pick up the body of a loved one who was killed in one of these clashes.
There's also been very conflicting stories, of course, about the death, or what appear to be, some, from some point of view, assassination of supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. But then again, there were people killed over in Sinai in the desert who were in minibuses, who were Egyptian soldiers.
Yeah, that's right. There's been a real uptick in violence in the Sinai, which was never a very safe place to be an Egyptian soldier. I mean, it's really quite lawless and tribal over there in the first place. But here in Cairo, I got to say that the overwhelming fact that we're all grappling with is the pileup of bodies. You know, not enough room at the morgue, families throwing outside, crowds of toughs supporting General Sisi, also around the morgue, intimidating members of the Muslim Brotherhood who come for their loved ones, and also intimidating journalists who try to come to film this situation. It was really very stark to see the pace that the dead bodies piled up during some of these fights at the makeshift field hospitals that the Brotherhood set up in mosques around the city. It just, even though I can't tell you for a fact how many people were killed, to see how fast they were falling was really quite bracing.
Well, we're also getting reports of the Muslim Brotherhood attacking Coptic Christians and assaulting Christians. What about that from your perspective?
I would say that there's a distinction to be drawn there. There is absolutely a backlash by supporters of President Morsi against Coptic Christians. There have been churches attacked around the country, and there is an obvious and palpable hostility to Coptic Christians because of the Coptic Pope's signs of support for this takeover. At the same time, the Muslim Brotherhood, as an organization, has denounced those killings. It has denounced those attacks on churches. So the government here is saying, look, the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization directing these crimes. And I think that's not quite right. I think the Brotherhood as an organization has made a strategic decision to try to avoid violence, that violence is not in its interest. But it no longer controls the people on the street. There are spasms of anger and vengeance, and a lot of that is being directed at innocent Coptic Christians.
We're talking to David Kirkpatrick, who's with us from Cairo. He's Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times. And David, how do you read, in reading you, the foreign minister spokesman saying this is emergency law for only 1 month and the president and parliamentary election has a military timetable of 2014? I mean, can this kind of heavy military presence that we're seeing and crackdown just continue interminably, or do they have a terminal date?
Well, you know, the experience of Middle Eastern dictators is that emergency law is a hard habit to break. You know, once you've set you and your police force above any checks or scrutiny, it would be remarkable to then say, okay, I now submit to the rule of law and a democratic process and will voluntarily hold myself accountable. That would be a historically extraordinary event. So right now they're promising this timetable, but it's always, you know, that's coming. As soon as we solve this pressing security issue, we'll get right around to that democracy stuff, which after all is what former President Hosni Mubarak said for 30 years. He installed a similar emergency law after the assassination of President Sadat brought him to power in 1981, and he kept it for 30 years.
Well, in calling the Muslim Brotherhood terrorists and possibly banning them, that may be imminent indeed. Are they simply creating more terrorists and more jihadists, and as a result, maybe creating a situation that's going to be like Syria?
Well, the Islamists, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, will tell you that right away, that the behavior of the state is only creating more terrorists. And they have a point. You know, the leaders who became the colonel of al-Qaeda came to their ideas and were radicalized by their experience in Egyptian prisons. So there's a lot of history to make that case. In point of fact, you know, it's too soon to tell. You know, we haven't seen the formation of new terrorist groups, organized terrorist groups. And in contrast, we're seeing a fairly lively debate among Islamists and people within the Muslim Brotherhood over whether or not those tactics are useful or not. You know, the son of Herat al-Shatir, who is the most important Brotherhood leader now in jail, like so many of them, put out a message over Twitter recently saying, look, in Iran, they were peaceful, and they won their revolution. In Algeria, when democratic elections were stolen, they took to the streets, and it was a 10-year-long bloody civil war that they lost. So not all of the Islamists have given up on civil disobedience and other nonviolent protest tactics, but that tension is on everyone's mind inside and outside of their movement.
David Kirkpatrick again with us from Cairo, Cairo bureau chief for The New York Times. And David, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
Also joining us for the rest of this segment is Nezer Al-Sayad. He's chair of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and is professor there of planning and urban history. And Professor Al-Sayad, good to have you with us back on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
Also good to have Janine Zakaria back with us, visiting lecturer at Stanford. She's former Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle Eastern correspondent for the Washington Post and joins us from down in the South Bay in Redwood City. Janine, thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Let me begin, Nezer Al-Sayad, with you, if I may. There's support for the regime. Actually, the head of the Al-Azhar Mosque is supporting the regime. The Saudis are supporting the regime, or the present military regime. But the United States appears to be, and Kuwait and the United Arab Emirate, but the United States appears to be on the fence and, in fact, has at least temporarily suspended military aid. But there have been articles saying the United States doesn't really have much leverage here. How do you see it?
Yes, I believe that this is absolutely true. The United States has lost both leverage and, in the eyes of many Egyptians, also credibility, either in being a broker or in being even a supporter of a democratic process. I think that the mistake that was made earlier has to do with the inability to properly recognize what happened on June 30th of 2013 and the fact that the United States hedged its bet whether that is a military coup or it's not a military coup. It took its time to decide that it's not a military coup. And then after that, it actually changed its mind, deciding, well, you know, the army is really in charge, so maybe it's a military coup. The U.S. position at best can be described as fundamentally confused. As of this moment, I don't think that there's any clarity in that position. I think the suspension of military aid, you know, I think that the visits that Senator Graham and Senator McCain did to Egypt, which were completely unsuccessful, only heightened the feeling of many in Egypt, ironically on both sides, that the United States does not know exactly what it's doing in the Middle East.
Well, Janine Zakaria, Saudi Arabia has essentially said that they will make up the $1.3 billion in military aid if the United States doesn't come through. They have a blank check, at least they've offered, although they've done that before with the Palestinians. And the EU is sending warnings that there won't be support. This present military regime under Sisi appears to be pretty entrenched, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, as I mean, the article the professor was referring to that illustrated just how humiliated our envoys, Senator McCain and Senator Graham, were when they went to put pressure on General Sisi. The fact that Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel called him 17 times to urge him to not crack down, a crackdown that's led to 1,000 deaths. It does seem to suggest that the U.S. has no leverage. I mean, the aid question is a bit of a red herring, given that it's, you know, $1.5 billion. I think that's half of 1% of the Egyptian GDP, and with the Gulf stepping in, it's true that it's not a meaningful amount, but that said, you know, the Egyptians, they're just assuming that the U.S. is not going to cut the aid. It's still very important for them. They still want American F-16s. They still want the military cooperation that continues on a subtle level. But I'd say right now, the U.S. has more to lose in terms of its interests than the Egyptian army does.
Well, we'd like to hear from you about the ongoing crisis in Egypt. If you have some thoughts, by all means, share them with us. If you have questions or comments, you are certainly welcome also to join us with those. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. And again, we welcome your involvement in the program. This is only a half-hour segment, so if you have some strong feelings one way or the other, please feel free to express them now. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Professor Al-Sayed, I'm also interested in finding out just what kind of potential political solution there can actually be. I mean, one can go ahead with assuming or hoping that the crackdown by the security forces will abate somehow. But even if violence abates, political solution at this point does not seem very clear or likely.
Yes, I think you're right, Michael. However, I think it is very important also to recognize that the transitional government that the military has put in place under the acting president, Adli Mansour, and the committees that he has already put in place to supposedly rewrite a constitution that would be voted on, so on and so forth, that all of these things are still going on. In fact, Egyptian newspapers are full of information and news about the new structure of the parliament, about whether religious parties would be allowed to participate in elections or not. So I think that track and the transition that el-Sisi announced may, in fact, continue to bear some fruit at some point in time. They had put a deadline of 6 months or so on it. It's unclear to me that they will be able to achieve that at all. But we'll have to wait and see. Now, on the other hand, I also agree with David that it looks like that the situation on the ground will continue to be extremely unsafe. I don't believe that Egypt will become like Syria, which is something that you had indicated in your discussion with David. I think what is more likely is...
That is something that President Erdogan said was imminent when he spoke about the ongoing crisis, the president
of
Turkey.
Yes, and in a sense, again, he's referring to the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood is an organization that has been around for 80 years and has actually been underground for 80 years. The problem is, of course, is that there are so many other organizations that are not the Muslim Brotherhood organizations but share their ideology, and they are certainly the ones that are engaged in what one can consider terrorist attacks. In the minds of many Egyptians today, there is no distinction. between the Muslim Brotherhood and the other organizations that are affiliated with them, who have engaged against, you know, the armed forces, who have engaged against the security forces in Sinai and in other Egyptian cities. And I think that this is where the danger lies. The danger is that Egypt could go into a period of political instability for a very long time with underground organizations that are attacking tourists, that are attacking military forces, that are attacking security forces, so on and so forth. We'll have to wait and see.
And Janine Zakaria, how do you read what the response of the Egyptian people will be to the release of Hosni Mubarak? I mean, this seems to be almost unbelievable in light of what happened a couple of years ago in Tahrir Square and his being sent to prison and all these charges against him that were forthcoming at the time.
Well, it's going to be hard to say. I think it's going to be divisive. There might be some people who are longing for the stability that that regime, albeit autocratic and despotic, was in many ways, or who may welcome this. But I think overwhelmingly, you'll probably see more of a negative reaction. I mean, the key question from February 2011 has been answered, namely, will the regime last beyond Mubarak's ouster? And I think it's clear that his military regime, Hosni Mubarak was a military general, remember, did last and continued. So in many ways, we'll have to see, you know, what the military does with him, if anything, or if he'll keep a lower profile. I imagine that he will go into some sort of seclusion for a while, but certainly will be interesting to watch.
And Janine Zakaria, again, is former Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post, presently visiting lecturer at Stanford. Nazar Al-Sayed is chair of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at UC Berkeley and professor there of planning and urban history. Let me go right to your calls, and we go first to Murad. Good morning.
Good morning to you, sir.
Yes, welcome. You're on the air.
Abd al-Fattah al-Sisi. It was Hosni Mubarak's right hand. Abd al-Fattah al-Sisi is related to me in some way, and I know in fact that this Hosni Mubarak stepping down was nothing but a game. You know, and the U.S. government know about this stuff, so I don't know why you guys are like beating around the bush. From the beginning to the end, it was a game. He was going to step down, try to save some life, and he come back again.
Well, El-Sisi was very close to Hosni Mubarak, Nazar Al-Sayed. Whether or not this was orchestrated from the beginning, of course, is kind of hard to put into perspective. But there are so many people in this present military regime that have close ties to Mubarak.
Absolutely. I think it is important to remember that El-Sisi was, in fact, in charge of military intelligence. He was Mubarak's right-hand man, if you will, in terms of dealing particularly with Israel and issues in Sinai. However, I think you have to remember that when Egypt was governed for 16 months by SCAF, which is the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, of which El-Sisi was a member under the old regime, it was very clear at that time that the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces decided it's not to its best interest to keep Mubarak on. They acted absolutely to preserve the power and the influence that the military has over the Egyptian economy and, in fact, the privileges that they also enjoy. El-Sisi just basically acted as one of the generals who sits on that council. He was the youngest. He found himself, ironically being the youngest, elevated to the position of being Minister of Defense and Chief of the Armed Forces under Morsi. How did this happen and why did Morsi make that decision is unclear. It is something that, again, history will have to judge. So I actually don't believe the conspiracy theory that your caller was advocating. I think it is much more likely to be seen in light of the fact that the military had certain best interests and it acted on its best interests. When its best interest was to remove Mubarak, they removed him. Whether he's going to be released or not, again, today is actually a matter for the courts, just like it will be with Mohamed Morsi.
Let me bring another caller on, and that's you, Patrick. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm impressed with the speakers, and I'm privileged to ask a question. My question is rather prescriptive, so it may be more difficult to answer. It's also more broadly about young democracies. We see time and time again where young democracies, the minority doesn't acquiesce. And in Egypt, I don't know who the majority or minority is. However, the travesty that's occurred and seems to continue to occur, you know, leads me to believe that the minority doesn't acquiesce, similar to other young democracies. What can we do, or what structural components can we put in place with young democracies like Egypt that will foster tolerance or foster at least more stability without a despot you know, in place, a young democracy, if we're shooting for that?
Well, it's an important question, a difficult one to speak to in a general way. But Janine Zakaria, let's get some reading from you on this.
Well, I think it's a good point, and I think it gets to, the, you know, largely the heart of the matter. You know, Michael, I remember in 2003 when President Bush said we tolerated 60 years of autocracy in the Middle East in order to get stability, and we're not going to do it anymore. And I think this whole question of democracy versus stability and what are the goals for these nations, and I think we're reverting now to a period, at least from the U.S. perspective, where we just need stability right now, right? Because the fact of the matter is that we, you know, did not stand with Mohamed Morsi after he was elected, albeit he did seize power in a way that, you know, upset most of the country and the military, and he didn't act totally democratically, but he was elected. So is democracy going to be about elections? Is it going to be about rule of law that is just? And frankly, yeah, it's going to be a long process of working with nations to at least achieve something. And we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. We've got to see what we can achieve in some of these places. Right now, we can't stop a military or police force from just mowing down people by the hundreds. So I think we have to really scale back our expectations.
But if you are an Islamist and your candidate was elected in a democratic election and suddenly he was removed and supplanted by, call it a coup or whatever you like, it doesn't necessarily give you a lot of faith in democracy, does it?
No, I guess it doesn't, but this whole question of trying to integrate Islamists into the political process is something that's unfolding around the region, right? I mean, you had a similar situation when Hamas took power and won an election and, you know, trying to figure out how are they going to be political players, you know, and the U.S. decided not to recognize them. You had it with Hezbollah in Lebanon. And so we're sort of looking at this in different ways, depending on the country and depending on our interests. And on the ground, I think, you know, there's a sharp learning curve for Islamists and trying to figure out what do we want to do in terms of a democracy. I mean, they want to be in power, right? So, I mean, democracy is sort of, I think, a secondary issue for them.
Let me give you a couple of comments that have come over our website. Stav writes, the army was left with little choice but to release Mubarak. What would it mean to continue with his trial now that they are guiltier than he? Regina writes, it seems to me the United States' continuing financial support to Egypt is necessary in order to have access to the Suez Canal, in order to continue military protection and trade for the United States and many other countries. And we ought to mention that military exercise was canceled. That may just be symbolic window dressing, but nevertheless is a fact now between the United States and Egypt. Let me get another of your calls on. Francesco, good morning.
Hi, my name is Francesco. I'm calling from San Francisco. I think Morsi was an undercover agent from Mubarak in that organization. And the reason is that they disqualified everyone in that organization except Morsi. Morsi was there to come and cause chaos in the country so that military can come back. This is exactly like before Mubarak was in power.
Boy, there's another theory that one hasn't heard too much of, Nazar al-Sayyan. Morsi was approved. He's right about that, isn't he?
Yes, but, you know, I think, and this goes back to actually the earlier caller, I think what is extremely important to recognize at this moment in Middle East history is that while elections have been bringing certain people to power, and clearly Morsi was elected, but he was elected also with a razor thin edge, and one that is not at all different, if you will. The election was as contested as the election of Bush versus Gore in 2000. But I think that the important point here is that there are very specific forms of democracy that exist in the world today, one of which is electoral democracy. What we've seen in Egypt, particularly between June 30th and July 3rd, when the military government or the military supposedly removed the government of Mohamed Morsi, is a form of direct democracy, where one can actually argue if Morsi was elected by 11 million people in June of 2012, he was removed by 22 million people in June 30th of 2013.
We're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time, but I want to thank Nazar al-Sayyad, thank Janine Zakaria, and thanks to David Kirkpatrick. When we return, whole other subject up for discussion, the Coastal Commission levying fines. I'm Michael Krasny.